Is this going to be?
If you just listen to me for a moment, I'll be glad to comment upon the invitation. If you just listen to me. I understand that Miss Judith Mage, who is a candidate for vice president, is here and is going to speak tomorrow to students. This is my opportunity to speak to students. Now, just a moment. Just a moment. She'll have every opportunity to have all the exchange she wants. I have 25 minutes, and I came here to speak to the students of Syracuse University. And I'd be happy to share that time with students, just as she will have the opportunity to share her time with students. No, you have your opportunity tomorrow. I won't be here to heckle you. If you're not capable of getting your own audience, you're a candidate for vice president. I received no invitation in advance. Will you listen to me, please? Will you listen to me, please? I came here. I was invited by the students of Syracuse University to be here. And I intend to speak to them, and I intend to listen to them. Apparently, it did not occur to you to accept it, except under circumstances that would disrupt my audience. Well, I can stand here and spend the entire half hour in silence. Or I'd be glad to proceed. And I trust that your audience tomorrow night will give you more courtesy than you are giving me. Now, if I may proceed. Miss Mangy, will you write me a letter, please, and let me go on with my message?
We want Muskie!
I'm willing to take it. Now, may I speak to the rest of you? I think I might say at the outset, that I doubt that it will do me any good to confess that I'm a Cornelian here on the Syracuse campus.
Don't be so indecisive, speak.
You know, I remember Syracuse back in 1936. I remember Syracuse back in 1936, when as a young law student, I observed the political campaign of that year. And at that time, a Democratic state convention was being held here in Syracuse. And because of the turbulence of the times, a number of us who are young and foolish came up here to Syracuse to see if we couldn't get in to see the convention, especially on the night that Franklin Roosevelt was to address it. And we succeeded in crashing it and taking the front row seats, much as these people have here today. And it was a great experience in those days, and I've been interested in American public life and in the concern of young people in public life ever since. I have this brief message, and then I'd be glad to take questions. When the British Army surrendered at Yorktown, their band played, the world turned upside down. For many Americans, that might well be the theme song of 1968. You know, I'm really not interested in engaging in a shouting match. Well, you fellas go on and use up all the time you need to wear yourselves out, and I'll take what time is left. Or anyone else. Giving up the time that I was invited to spend here. You've got your platform tomorrow. Why can't you be satisfied with it? And let me have mine today. I'd like to discuss them too. And I could if it weren't for your strident voice. Voice that is, but let me say this to you. I don't know whose voice that is, and apparently you have no ears, only a voice. But let me say this to you. Let me say this to you. You're trying to tell us that you're interested in a discussion, but you're interested in only a one-way discussion. And you want it on your terms. You don't want to listen. You only want to make noises. And noisemakers have never been a constructive force in any society. What's described as peace and freedom, this little racket down here to the left. That's peace and freedom. Well, it's a little difficult to speak every time I raise my voice. They use these bullhorns. All right, let's try it anyway. Let's try it anyway. And you'll have to listen because I'm not going to shout. We're here to talk, I hope, about some of the serious problems that confront us here in our society in this election year of 1968. Ours is a bewildered society. The young and the old, the poor and the affluent, and the black and the white feel troubled, restless, and insecure. Why, ask the old, should a society which pledges social security for the elderly let loose the forces of disruption which threaten our security? Why, ask the poor, should a society where the good things in life are spread before us on television, in the newspapers and magazines, and in the shop windows, deny them to us? Why, ask the affluent, should a society which produces great material wealth diminish the enjoyment of its fruits by contamination of our environment? Why, ask black Americans, should a society which proclaims equality permit so much inequality? And why, ask middle white Americans, should our hard-earned gains be threatened because others haven't made it? Those questions are inherent in any society. Those who have want to protect what they have and enjoy a little more. And those who do not have want to share the fruits of freedom. In 1968, the crises in our foreign and our domestic politics have intensified those questions. When we add to the accumulation of social injustices and the impact of crowding, of bad urban planning, of human frailty and institutional rigidity, the potential dangers for our society are apparent. Then it is that the crisis in individual identity and social tranquility erupts. As I reflect on the events of this past year, I think the most eloquent expression of every man's cry was the sign carried by the striking garbage man of Memphis. I am a man. This is what our young people want us to know. This is what our black citizens want us to know. This is what many of our angry white citizens are saying. It finds expression in many ways, but the central message is the same. We want to be free, free of meaningless restrictions, free from discrimination, free from fear, free from threats to our safety, free from the sense of being pawns in some cosmic game. And the politicians sense this, but their responses differ. And therein lies the importance of the 1968 presidential campaign. Richard Nixon has responded by pretending that a simple change in party labels at the White House will correct all our ills. But under the new label are the same old ingredients of apathy, indifference, and insensitivity which accumulated disastrous social and economic problems through the 1950s. His concern is political power, not social reform. His answer is putting the lid on, not releasing the energies of our society for constructive purposes. George Wallace is also interested in political power. His appeals to fear and to hate are more blatant than Mr. Nixon's. His emphasis on repression and his willingness to employ social division are more brutal. But the ultimate import of his campaign is not far from Mr. Nixon's. Exploit the anxieties of society for political gain and ignore the consequences for democratic processes, social tranquility, or individual dignity. Faced with those prospects, and unhappy because their choice did not win at Chicago, some Americans say they have no choice, and they are opting out. They criticize our political parties, and understandably so. They reject the political systems for reasons that are understandable. But I say there is a choice in 1968, but only voters can make it. I say the political system can work, but only the voters can make it work. And I say the political process can improve, but only the voters can do it. Most of the ills of our political parties are not the products of evil men and women. They are the result of apathy in the past. the indifference of those who, because of defeat, chose to opt out, thus leaving the system, its structure, its organization, and its purposes to those who are less nobly motivated. You have a double chance this year to help elect a president and to initiate reforms in our political system. And I can tell you from personal experience that it can be done. There are several reforms I recommend for your consideration. Lower the voting age to 18. Provide for the popular election of the president. Establish the one-man, one-vote principle for the selection of delegates to state and national conventions. And that selection preferably should be by popular election. And fourth, broaden the basis for participation in the parties by young people, minority groups, and women, not as separate segments of political committees, but as equal partners in the business of politics. Those changes will not come overnight, and they will not come if those who have shown concern this year, if those who have chosen to become involved this year, if those who are dissatisfied with the system this year prove that they are capable of the same apathy, the same withdrawal from the system as those in the past who've been responsible for the inequities in our present system. I say that this is the year. I say that you do have a strident voice, don't you, Miss Major? Does it ever occur to you to listen? Would you let me dictate what your speech will be tomorrow, Miss Magee? Miss Magee, would you be quiet and let me talk? Do you have any conception at all of what orderly debate is like? She isn't going about it in what I consider to be an orderly way. I came here for a specific purpose, and I intend to carry out that purpose despite her stridency on the sidelines. I love women. I married one. I think at this point, the only possible chance I have to continue this, and I'm addressing this to the students I came to speak to and listen to, and I intend to stick to that objective and not be bulldozed into another one. Now, I promised that I'd have a brief speech, and it wouldn't have been as long as it's been if I'd been given a chance to deliver it, to be followed by questions, and I'll take them from the audience. Would you speak up just a little louder?
These questions about Vietnam. You're able to speak up louder. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Well, I'd like to hear that question.
Can you hear me now, sir?
Yes, I can.
This question encompasses a pretty good amount of the question in Vietnam itself. Do you believe a person who actually does not believe we belong there, who has deep moral objections to killing people he believes should not be murdered, should be put in jail for 5 years for refusing to fight in a war he has no desire to participate in?
That question is poses the question that's posed by any member of a free society. Whether to obey the laws or to break them, and if the laws are unsatisfactory, whether to move by the democratic process to change them. We are a government of laws, and when laws are violated, they must be enforced. The way to change them, and this was Robert Kennedy's message, this is my message. Everyone, of course, if he feels deeply enough about what he considers to be the inequity of a law, is free to break it. But I assume that the drama of breaking it includes the willingness to take the penalty for doing so. If you can break laws, any laws, without penalty, what's the drama? The result is anarchy. One way of doing it is by avoiding the kind of strident opposition which generates a reaction. No, I'll tell you what my answer is to Chicago. We've got to set up, first of all, lines of communication between those who are dissatisfied with the system and the process. Your idea of communication is to do it on your terms. That's not communication. Young lady, I'll be glad to try to answer your question as soon as these noisemakers let me. Miss Meiji, I've been answering that question for 6 weeks and you haven't listened, and I don't expect to have you listen in 10 minutes today. If you haven't been willing to listen to what I've said for 5 weeks, you're not willing now. Now may I listen to this question and try to answer it. Now the question is, with respect to Chicago and the unfortunate developments there, what do we do to avoid that kind of development again? The first step is to establish communication. And I think there's got to be a willingness on the part of those in authority to take the initiative to set up communications with people who are dissatisfied and truly concerned about our society and about its problems. There's a tendency on the part of those in authority and on the part of those who have made it in society to protect what they have, to protect the status quo, and to resist the importunities of those who haven't made it or who are trying to make an entry into society in the broad mainstream of our country. I think that one of the manifestations of our affluence of the past 8 years has been an increasing desire on the part of people who benefit from the status quo to keep the status quo as it is. I think that's a mistake. I think we've got to take the initiative. And I think that those in authority who fail to do it are more to be blamed than those who are trying to come in. That's the first concept that I'd emphasize. The second point I'd make is this, that we need desperately to upgrade our law enforcement agencies in this country, to make them not just police forces, but keepers of order in the humane, compassionate, understanding sense. In order to do that, we've got to provide the resources at the local, state, and indeed the federal level to hire people who are properly trained, to equip them properly, to pay them adequately, to equip them to do law enforcement not in the old policeman's club method, but in the sophisticated ways which we've learned in the federal agencies such as FBI and so on. If you want me to give you the courtesy of answering your question, you allow me to answer the question of this young lady. Really, you people have got a lot to learn. How can you? Your mouths are open all the time. You can learn only by listening. The third thing that we must do, and I want to answer this question, is to get at the social causes of unrest in our society. Here we have the greatest potential for serving the needs of all Americans by creating opportunity, eliminating unacceptable living conditions that any society ever has. And yet we have these unacceptable conditions about which we're doing too little today. And we must get at them. We've made great strides forward in recent years, but we haven't closed the gap between hopelessness and opportunity and hope for too many Americans. And that is really the hard core of the problem in the question which you raised. You will not have a question because you haven't given me the courtesy of a hearing, Miss Major. I'm going to answer questions from these students. When you learn to be courteous, I'll return it. Yes.
What do you propose to do to get those farcical clocks in Paris moving so you can get us out of Vietnam?
I'll be glad to discuss the Vietnam question in the way I have. And if you listen, I'll spell it out. First of all, I'll give you my commitments on Vietnam and then try to describe what would be my approach to it. I'm committed, and so is the Vice President, against any escalation of the war in Vietnam. I'm committed to a negotiated settlement as the sensible way to end the war. I'm committed to the taking of calculated risks in order to move to a negotiated settlement. Now, there are two problems that confront us as we consider that problem. One, we don't know whether or not the other side is committed to the idea of a negotiated settlement in its own best interests. Miss Major, you asked me to discuss Vietnam, and the moment I do, you open your mouth again. I've never run into such a discourteous opponent in my life. I must say you're not very persuasive. May I finish? I've said that I'm committed to negotiated settlement, but we don't know that the other side is committed to negotiated settlement in its own interests. It is not going to negotiate a settlement as a favor to us. It will do so only when it feels that it would be a favor to itself. Now, how do we... The two problems then. One, if it hasn't made such a commitment, and it may conceivably have done so and not disclosed it, if it hasn't done so, how do we persuade it to make such a commitment? And secondly, whether or not it's made such a commitment, how can we move toward the negotiating table? Now, a number of devices are suggested to achieve this objective. The latest suggestion upon which everybody seems to hang is the discontinuance of the rest of the bombing in North Vietnam. Now, as the papers have disclosed in recent days, I wrote a letter to the President last January suggesting an unconditional halt to the bombing in January, and I suspect that many others did the same thing, and certainly there was a great public outcry on the part of many Americans to do just that. So on March 31st, he discontinued 90% of the bombing insofar as the population of North Vietnam is concerned, reserving the remaining bombing for what he described as minimal protection for those of our troops stationed just south of the DMZ. Now, whether or not...
Ignore.
Really, your beauties over here, your real beauties. I don't know how you'd know what a lie is. You don't open your ears long enough to listen. May I finish, please? I'll try to make myself heard through that screen. So now, we discontinued 90% of the bombing on March 31st, and that decision was hailed by, I think, most Americans as the decision which probably or possibly could move us toward substantive negotiations. It did not have that resolve. All we got was talks in Paris that haven't visibly moved toward substantive negotiations. Now it is argued that discontinuing the other 10% would achieve what discontinuing the 90% did not achieve. In other words, that this additional move would move us toward substantive negotiations. There's no indication as yet, no evidence of the slightest kind to my knowledge that it would. I think that we ought to be prepared to do that. I think we ought to be prepared to take a risk to do it, as I was back in January. If there's any evidence at all that the North Vietnamese would also regard it as an opportunity to move toward a negotiated settlement. I think it's possible that if we play that card at the right time, it might have that effect, that if it's played at the wrong time, we might be throwing the card away. Now, how do you decide what the right time is? Well, obviously, the way to do it, or one way to do it,